Hello and welcome back to the Country Intelligence Report. We are your hosts, Spencer Bentley, Devin Florzak, and Terrell Cummings. This week, we will be exploring a pretty interesting conversation topic that we have been sort of broaching in various ways on the show here around all of the intricacies that go into defense contracting and some of the vehicles available for small businesses to enter into this world, and sort of just demystifying a lot of the questions and concerns that small businesses may have as they look to enter into federal contracting. And specifically, we will be discussing the world of SBIRs and STTRs. The SBIR is a Small Business Innovation Research Program. The STTR is a Small Business Technology Transfer. And to get us started, we will hand it over to Devin Florzak, who will just sort of introduce us to the programs and give us a better understanding of who they're for, why they exist, and how they can be leveraged by small businesses. Devin.
Yeah, I think we can look at this as a more alternative way of doing business with the Department of Defense and Department of Energy. Obviously the more traditional way is, scanning for contracts, looking for sources sought, seeing what organizations are looking for, searching for all those RFPs, trying to find all that. But these two programs seem to be more specific towards the R&D side of things. Pretty much in general, it's more so for, if you have an idea and you think it could be funded by the government, and you think the government can use it, and you think it could also be potentially commercialized, these are the programs for you. So for the SBIR, Spencer, as you mentioned, it's a Small Business Innovation Research Program. And it's essentially a government initiative that encourages, small businesses in the United States to engage in R&D, with the potential for commercialization. Of course, with all R&D, there's a lot of companies that start just from doing R&D. One of the big ones is Qualcomm. There's actually an SBIR Hall of Fame, funny enough, they were inducted to it in 2011. Back in the 1980s. Essentially they started with an idea of initially developing commuter chips, and they applied for some SBIR grants. At the time they had 35 employees, and now their workforce is of over 17,000 people. Pretty big company now, and they started off with the modest beginnings of, being a small business, going through the SBIR program. Just starting with one idea, and then now they have a company that holds over 13,000 patents. So, it's pretty big. And another one is, iRobot. Everyone knows the Roomba, It's one of those companies where, makes really generic products, but then also does things with the DoD and DOE. Similar to 3M. 3M, we see, they have their paper products, but then they also do some projects for, space exploration. So a lot of these companies, from the front end, they offer commercial products, but a lot of them did get their start with funding from, the government and working on, more military, based applications. So with, iRobot, they've used SBIRs to initially help the military by, making different types of autonomous robotics throughout the years. One of their main ones was the PackBot, which is being used for bomb disposal right now. They also assisted with something called the Sea Glider, which is an autonomous underwater vehicle. It's an AUV instead of a UAV. These companies, again, it seems like a lot of them, have these ideas that they want to assist the government with, but, try to better the world. And then they end up commercializing some of these things, bringing more commercial products once they actually get that backing from the government.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Definitely a unique vehicle that I'm sure, that the average small business may not know about. And this one sort of being oriented towards more innovation and products, and less towards services. It makes it really unique, I think. Mm-hmm. And seeing these success stories as well, I think could be really enlightening for the engineers and the innovators out there that may have a good idea but aren't quite sure how to get in front of the proper audience in the federal government. Mm-hmm. This is a really great program here. So why don't you, sort of walk us through how they should understand the application process, and, even as it comes to, finding and responding to these sort of solicitations.
Yeah. So, solicitations seem to be found just on SBIR and STTR specific government websites. The DOE has their own solicitation, portals that you can go under, and you can kind of see, the ideas that they're looking to be formed. When I've looked at these, and I've talked with a couple of companies that have been through the SBIR process, SBIR. Typically, a lot of these solicitations are really generic, and then they leave it up to the company to use their imagination and try to get it done. So, they might, these solicitations might just be a page long and say, hey, we're looking for this. They don't really mention, how it should be done, but they're just wondering if someone could figure out and get it done. There are these portals out there for both the DOD and DOE. And like I said before, companies have also approached, SBIR and STTDR with the DOE and DOD with their own ideas. These two, programs are pretty much open to interpretation, and you can even apply for your own idea. Obviously that takes a little bit more legwork, and then you need to do the marketing work as well to see if there's eventually, any organization that will fund that research. Mm-hmm. Like we said, if you have an idea, you might be able to, get it funded through one of these.
One of these programs. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, we sort of understand how to find these solicitations and the structure of them. What about how should they go about understanding the proposal process, specifically writing a strong proposal?
Yeah. So I think, when it was explained to me before that a lot of these, proposals that are written, they're written more so like a, university research paper. It's very detailed, very technical language, straight to the point. And, obviously a lot of these papers go out to a audience, a more government audience that, has to review it and understand what you're trying to do, in a concise manner. Cause, they need to figure out, who could actually, accomplish the task at hand. And at the same time, see if, their application might have any merit, with how it's described. Mm-hmm. So I think that, when you're writing these proposals, I have we haven't actually done any of this. We've talked to companies though, that do have their own SBIR applications out there. And, like I said, it seems like it's more so through a, university research paper lens, where, you have to be, like I said, very concise to the point and, make sure that you're explaining everything clearly.
It makes sense. So you have to have sort of a high technical acumen and understand and be able to express your idea probably in a very granular way. So you have to have a very strong command of the technical aspects of your idea, which makes sense given the vehicle that you're applying towards. Mm-hmm. So then you've written the proposal, you're in the process of writing the proposal. How do they go about sort of demonstrating the project's viability? Is it something where, you have to lay it out completely in the proposal? Is it, I'm not sure about the structure of this particular program, but, what insights do you have on the viability aspects of it?
Yeah. So, typically, goals are set in the proposal, and they're more so technical goals, where, you might say if you're working on an application, that say, for example, one of the ones I was familiar with, which I was talking to you guys before, was this company that was trying to pretty much be able to spray paint metallurgist based material onto aircraft and be able to, quickly repair them, without leaving the tarmac. And so, one of their goals might have been, be able to create, a sort of laser system that only uses, like 1,000 watts of energy or less, pretty much, I think they're more so very like technical goals. And at that point you're kind of like, defined like the constraints of your project and saying like, if we want, this sort of product to work, in a real life scenario, it needs to be, for that example, it needs to be like low energy, low resource cost, and you need to be able to, do it over and over and over again. So, like I said, one of those goals might be, low energy, 1,000 watts of power used or less, per, spray, for example. Low resource cost, make sure that every time you do spray the material, it might be low cost, so keep that sort of, per unit price down. And then time, time could be a factor. You could say, it will take, a goal could be like, by the time that you set up the equipment, you fix the piece of the aircraft, and then by the time it dries and it's good to go, you could say like, keep it under an hour, something like that. So yeah, I would say, when you're writing these proposals, you want to keep it very, technically based, keep your goals like related to the application, if that kind of makes sense.
Yeah. Makes sense. So, that's great. A lot of the insights you're providing around, how exactly to get these, applications going and how to strengthen the proposal, things like that. So let's then sort of pivot towards the funding and, how this is, how the funding sort of plays out. Cause this is, I think one of the most crucial aspects of these sort of programs, is, you have this great idea. You're able to write to it effectively, but then, the funding can be prohibitive depending on how it's structured within the program itself. And that can be a huge mitigating factor for small businesses out there looking to leverage something like this. So why don't you sort of walk us through how the funding works?
Yeah, at least with SBIR, which again, I think I'm more familiar with, potentially working with that one company. Like you said, I think, funding can be very prohibitive. With SBIR specifically, there are three phases of funding. Phase one is sort of your intro phase. That's where you, develop your proof of concept. It's what they call, it's your feasibility study phase. So here, this is where you're trying to aim, and establish your technical merit for the project. And then also explain, if you're able to, essentially make a proof of concept, what can be the commercial potential of the project. And so, this phase here, it's usually not a lot of money. From what I've seen, it's usually around, somewhere around, $500,000 or less. And it's typically, they typically only give you, 6 to 12 months to get it done. And so it's usually a short time period, quick turnaround, not a lot of funding, which can be stressful, for companies. The one company that I was talking with, it was essentially one guy, working on this laser application for the Air Force. And, he had his normal job and he said that he would go in, after his job and work on it on the weekends, whenever he had time. Because, like I said, that phase one funding is not a lot of money, and it's not a lot of time. So, after he got done working, 8 to 5 on his normal job, he'd be there, 6 to 10, 6 to 12, pretty much every night and on the weekends as well. And that's where, I think a lot of these, applications in phase one are born from. It's just, people with ideas that, want to actually like grind and put in the hours to get it done. So, if you're someone like that and you have an idea where, it's going to be a time commitment, but, you think you can get it done in, half a year, that might be for you. And then for phase two, so like I said, three phases, you know, phase two is more so focused on, you know, the development of the product. And here, this is where you need to do some marketing and do some legwork on trying to figure out, you know, what agencies, you know, what offices within those agencies might fund your product. And this is more so, you know, talking with, you know, those potential clients and trying to, you know, source that funding. So, of course, you know, with this, I usually get more funding, you know, get up to the seven figure range. And they typically cover, you know, longer periods, you know, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, et cetera. And then the phase three is the more so the commercialization phase. So this is where you're actually expanding your product to, you know, be developed commercially. So whether it be, you know, for wide use in the government or, you know, wide use just in the general public domain, you know, this is where, you know, you're actually expanding and, you know, your R&D work is pretty much done. And you're just, you know, sort of expanding your product. You know, so obviously the, you know, the phase one, you know, funding that's pretty open. And obviously that's where you have to start. But you know, if you have a dream and, you know, you think the government can fund it, and can use that product or, you know, the general public domain to use that product, you know, I think SBIR is a great place to start.
That's great. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, it seems like this is sort of structured in such a way that they're really trying to sort of weed out some of the more viable ideas and structuring the funding to help sort of facilitate that, which makes sense given that it's tiered.
Yep.
But yeah, just it's my understanding, just based off of the reading that we've done, that the third tier is actually not really funded by the programs, but by the other sources. So like you said, when that marketing kicks in on phase two, you're really trying to sell your product to these other, mm-hmm. Agencies within the government, and they sort of take on the financial aspects of funding it from that point forward.
Yep.
Which makes a lot of sense.
And I think you know, we've gone to these different conferences, and I was talking to this guy at a Department of Energy conference, and he was saying that he had four SBIR phase one proposals out there. So you know, I think it's something that, you know, people have these ideas and they sort of fire them out there with a lot of volume and, you know, hoping one sticks on, and then, you know, if they get one, you know, they could work on that proposal for, you know, 6 to 12 months with phase one funding and, you know, hope to expand it to two and three. But, you know, I think the real challenge is, you know, getting that phase one over to phase two and three. Right. I think when I was talking with the one company that was working on their laser application with the Air Force, I think there was some wild statistic that, you know, only like 5 or 10% of the phase one funded projects actually make it to phase two.
Wow.
So it's, I think it's pretty challenging. I might be off of that statistic, but you know, from what I know and from what I've heard, you know, it's very tough to make it to phase two. But not to discourage anyone, but you know, if you have a good enough idea and a good enough proof of concept, and you know, you can find, you know, people to actually fund it, because they'll make use out of it, you know, great. You know, I think this is a, you know, a great program to use.
Yeah. Yeah. And all the more reason to make sure that, you know, you do have a viable idea before entering into this process. You know, it only makes sense that, it would become increasingly, you know, more difficult, as you get further along in the program, but, that should be all the more sort of motivation for you inventors out there to come with your idea as fully baked as you can. And you know, leverage these different, vehicles as much as you can. So, you know, just to round this conversation out, you know, what are the types of projects that typically get funded? You know, because it seems like such a wide open vehicle that can allow for a lot of different ideas to sort of, you know, get their legs underneath them. But, you know, just so we can help focus some of our listeners out there on what is truly, you know, viable for this sort of program. Can you give us a little insight into what sort of projects get typically funded?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think, you know, pretty much anything gets funding as long as you can find an actual use case for it. You know, the ideas that, you know, we've looked up, you know, very generic, you know, they all said, you know, life sciences, you know, things involving technology, anything involving energy or defense specifically. You know, I feel like it's more so for niche ideas, like I mentioned before, the one company working with their laser application for the Air Force. You know, things like that where it's niche, but it actually solves a critical problem that, you know, the government is seeing, whether that be in defense or energy or even, you know, in health, you know, the NIH. So, you know, you can either think like really broad or you can think really small and say like, you know, hey, it looks like, you know, there's a problem here, and there's a market for, you know, government customers that, you know, could have some use in getting this problem solved, albeit, you know, it might be small. You know, I think the government is just looking for problem solvers and innovators in general to give funding to, you know, make everyone's lives easier.
Makes sense. Well, there you have it, folks. A very, very powerful set of programs that you should definitely read up on and take advantage of if you are so inclined to: the SBIR, Small Business Innovation Research Program, and the STTR, Small Business Technology Transfer Program. Definitely worth the time if you are someone who is looking to get that big idea of yours off the ground and find a viable customer within the federal government. So, switching lanes here, we're going to go to our new segment of just sort of discussing things that have been on our mind, quick little tidbits that we've been interested in throughout the week. And Devin, I'll kick it over to you, man. What's been on your mind that you really can't let go of this week?
Yeah, my one buddy came through last week and was talking about his podcast. I forget what it's called. should have wrote it down or something. But he was talking about Taiwan and Spencer, like you mentioned before, they just elected a new president that seemed to be more democratic, more anti, you know, Eastern business philosophies and whatnot. Which, you know, I think I saw some news stories about it, but he was talking about this podcast and how it keeps him in the loop. And I feel like just in general, there's a lot of global news that is being brought more so to the mainstream. You know, my buddy, he's a PT by, you know, by train. So he works at the YMCA and trains people. But, you know, it seemed like not like people like him, but, you know, it seems like there's more of a spotlight on just general issues, more related to our industry and defense and just global contract, you know, which I thought was kind of interesting.
It is interesting. And, you know, me being a sort of an international relations nerd myself, I find it kind of refreshing that people are getting more clued in to, you know, sort of the world around them. It's becoming an increasingly small world with the, you know, the information revolution still roaring ahead. And I think, you know, especially with all of these different conflicts and things that have been in the news, it sort of just expands the lens for everyone to understand that, you know, especially as Americans, that, you know, it's a very interconnected world at this point. The things that happen overseas have direct impacts on us in one way or another. And, you know, the thing that I couldn't let go of as well is it's also related to Taiwan. And it's funny that you brought that up, but, you know, Taiwan is an interesting case on the international stage. They are extremely important in a lot of ways to the global economy. But they're sort of persona non grata in a lot of ways to these more formal institutions because of their contentious relationship with China and China's sort of insistence that they not be recognized formally. So, you know, it's sort of a mishmash of states and nation states globally that have ties to Taiwan. You know, for example, you know, America has sort of this position of, I forget the exact terminology, but basically it's you know, a lack of acknowledgement formally, but informally we have really direct ties with them. And it's just indicative of how the rest of, you know, Taiwan's partners have structured their relationships with them. And it's a small group because, you know, obviously China has a lot of influence on the world. And one of their allies, I should say, sort of formally cut ties with them because of the election of their president. And it's this small Pacific Island nation called Nauru. you know, it wouldn't make any other news. It wouldn't make news in any other circumstance, rather. But because, you know, Taiwan is such a strange sort of example of how international relations could play out when it comes to large power politics, you know, this small little Pacific Island nation has been on the news suddenly. Because it basically conceded to China's demands and decided to formally part ways with this newly elected president. But yeah, you know, little things like that. We'll see how this plays out. He's unapologetically Taiwanese and does very, very much disagrees with a lot of the Chinese government's way of doing business, to put it lightly. So we'll see how this plays out. And I'm sure we'll continue to touch on this through the years as this continues to sort of unfold for us. But yeah, well, thank you, folks. That's what we have for this episode. And we will be seeing you the next time. Over.
Thank you for listening to the Country Intelligence Report. Please like and subscribe to stay on top of the latest developments with the show. For more information on the Country Intelligence Group, please visit our website at www.countryintel.com. You can also be found across multiple social media platforms at Country Intel.